This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to the show, and yes, this week we're going to be talking with Laird Scranton. And his brand new book is called Point of Origin, Göbekli Tepe and the Spiritual Matrix for the World's Cosmologies. And are you there with us, Laird?
Yes, I am, Soraya. I'm very glad to be with you, too.
The opinions expressed by the host.
And I should stop the other thing from playing. All right. So this came out last month, right?
Actually, this has just been out this month. I guess you're right. It was February, not March. So it's within the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and it's on Inner Traditions.
Right.
And you already have another book written.
there's a follow-on to this book that was just submitted last week to the publisher. And one in progress that's beyond that. So.
and as I joked with you off the air, you're becoming Nick Redfern.
Yeah, I'm starting to understand, you know, these actors who go on the talk shows at night, you know, promoting their film that just came out. But they filmed the film like 5 years ago, and now they have to get revved back up into the mindset of whatever it is.
Right. You got to kind of go backwards and not give away too much of the new stuff before you have it complete.
That's right.
Now, go on.
No, okay, I've broken with tradition on a couple occasions and actually talked about the next book on one show. As I think the publisher's probably not too happy with me when I do that sort of thing.
Well, this, you got one of the pillars from Göbekli Tepe and stuff on the cover here, and obviously Göbekli Tepe is in the subtitle, but it's not a book about Göbekli Tepe. That just plays a part of it.
Right, and actually there was quite a bit of back and forth between me and the publisher about title, because from a marketing standpoint, they really wanted to emphasize Göbekli Tepe because it's an interesting topic to people these days. But I tried to argue that the book really isn't about that. I don't really want to mislead the readers into thinking that that's what this is about. Graham Hancock really says it best in his endorsement of the book. He says, the book's not about Göbekli Tepe. Instead, it puts Göbekli Tepe into a larger context. It tries to understand where things go from Göbekli Tepe.
Yeah, that makes sense. That definitely describes it really well. And your son actually wrote the introduction to this.
Yes, he has been a very close follower and contributor, and my daughter also has contributed information that has helped me along the way. And I thought that this was the book. I know he's a very good writer, and I didn't put any limitations on him on what he should or shouldn't say. And he expresses himself really well, and he has good insights about the material. I thought he was a good choice for a person to write the introduction.
All right. So there's so much information in this book. It's ridiculous. Now, the beginning of the book, you kind of have to go over a little bit of the stuff in your previous books, and which is really necessary for your work, because if people haven't read the four books prior to this, they're going to be a little lost if you just start up. So the first few chapters are kind of, you know, you talking about the previous books, adding in a little bit new here and there and some new connections, it seems like. But that must be frustrating for you to have to keep redoing that.
A little bit. In the upcoming books, I'm trying to do less of it, because I know that it can be a problem for people who are familiar with the first books to have to reread that material. So what I'm trying to do in future books here is provide the information that's needed as a foundation for what I'm going to talk about, and just refer back to the other books, you know, see this other book if you want more details about it.
Right. But it is hard because you have such a thick amount of data, so dense amount of data there that people really need to understand how important what you're talking about now is.
Well, so it's a balance to try to strike between the two. I think we go four chapters before I even mention Göbekli Tepe.
Yeah, yeah. And now what you're doing here is you're kind of tracing back using cosmology, language, and symbol and such the origins of our civilization.
Yeah, you're right. My wife, Risa, calls it Laird's Unified Theory. she's afraid that if I continue on this path too far, one day I'm going to find just the right piece of information and reality's going to go poof.
But, all right.
No, what I'm trying to do here is I became acquainted with Göbekli Tepe a couple of years ago. I'm friendly with John Anthony West, and he and Robert Schock were going to pay a visit to Göbekli Tepe and held a party at John's house one evening, as sort of a seeing them off kind of party. And I did a little bit of research about Göbekli Tepe for the first time just to be able to talk intelligently about it with them. But I could see that there is lots of familiar stuff there symbolically, things that you know, just intuitively seem to connect to later cultures, even though there's a 7,000-year gap between Göbekli Tepe at 10,000 BC in Turkey and ancient Egypt, you know, dynastic Egypt around 3,000 BC in Egypt. Plus, there's a gap of distance also.
Right.
But so part of the challenge for myself was how do you connect this stuff forward? If there's an inkling that it does connect forward, what could we possibly do in the absence of written texts and other that kind of evidence? What could possibly be done to try to link this stuff positively, in a positive way, to Egypt and Africa and India and Tibet and China and places like that?
Right. And this
that was sort of the mission statement for myself in writing the book.
And
That's what I was trying to get at.
When you make these connections, you kind of hold yourself to a pretty high standard there.
I seem to have lost you here, Sarai. I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. No.
That was weird. Seems like I have a bad mic here on my computer. So you make... I forgot what I just said.
Okay.
you hold yourself to a high standard in how you accept data.
That comes out of sort of a self-defense that I had to create for myself. The problem is that the human psyche is wired to find patterns and to seek them out, even when in situations where they might not really exist. And so, looks like I might have lost you here.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you again.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, so... the problem is, you know, a child looking up at the sky at the clouds, you know, it's very easy to imagine images that aren't really there. Oh, look, there's a rabbit. Oh, look, there's a horse. Well, the tendency for somebody like me who does research on ancient cultures is to perceive a pattern or perceive an interpretation and then go pursue it and sort of make it a self-fulfilling prophecy to look for the factual information that's going to support this idea that you came up with out of thin air. And so to protect against that, the rule I made for myself is that every interpretation has to start with a statement on the part of the cultures that I'm studying. In other words, they're the ones who say, the Dogon are the ones who say that their creation tradition describes how matter was formed. I don't. They say it, and then I just follow what they say. And so that's one way of keeping things rooted.
Right, right. And and when you talk about creation traditions, it almost seems like there's a dual layer there. Like there's the creation tradition of how matter is formed, but there's also kind of the relaunching of society as if like the end of the Ice Age wiped everything out. And this is also how they put a plan together to civilize us and give us agriculture and things like that.
Well, that's what it looks like to me, but it looks like that to me based on statements, clear statements that are made by some of the cultures. The Buddhists are one, the Dogon are one, the Egyptians are one, for that matter. The Egyptians make several different statements culturally about having received instruction or having received civilizing skills from an outside source. In Egypt, the written language, the hieroglyphic language, was deemed to have been given to them by their gods. And the plan for Giza supposedly fell from the sky, you know, a la a crop circle.
Really?
Yeah. So there are connections here in a lot of these cultures, but the Dogon are very clear about it, and the Buddhists are very clear about it. They flatly say, look, the most essential of the of these symbolic ideas that our system is based on, we receive from somebody as instruction. And it was part of, it was tagged to a civilizing plan that was meant to teach us how to be farmers. And so that's sort of the perspective I'm working from at Göbekli Tepe. And that's lucky because in the same region that Göbekli Tepe is located, in southeastern Turkey near the Fertile Crescent, also near where Mount Ararat was, places like that, in that region, that locality, you find the first evidence of cultivated grains, of domesticated animals, of metallurgy, working with metal.
Right.
Of stone masonry, that's Göbekli Tepe, excavating and carving stone. There are a number of other things going on in that region that make it look like you've got had a major revolution in civilization in that region that is hard to explain why it happened. At Göbekli Tepe, the carved stones we see there actually precede the earliest evidence we have of tools capable of building them. That's how early it is.
And that's so fascinating. I mean, and there's bound to be other sites like this, I would think, buried somewhere else in the world.
Yes, and also it looks to me as if, Göbekli Tepe, after about 1,000 years, one of the interesting things about it is that it was deliberately and carefully buried by somebody in a way that was meant not to damage the carvings on the stones, and that in a very respectful way. They can tell from the materials that were used to fill it that this was not natural, you know, like wind blown or water carried or anything like that. It's not natural erosion. Somebody deliberately buried the site. As we get on into the next books, I talk about a couple of other later sites that were also deliberately buried, but where the people who buried the sites left symbolic messages as to why they did it. And it looks to me as if there's deliberate symbolism here. Part of it is to say, look, this site completed its purpose, and our burying it shows you that. Huh. That if the purpose had been interrupted, it wouldn't have been buried. But because it came to full completion, burying it is sort of a ritual that says that.
Now, if I remember right, Andrew Collins had suggested that parts of Göbekli Tepe were buried and then new parts built.
It was built over time at different archaeological levels, sort of stratigraphic levels. There are multiple stone circles that are all very much like one another at Göbekli Tepe. It's hard to explain why was that done, because clearly, you know, in some cultures, a structure had to be rebuilt, or an older temple was superseded by a newer temple. But these structures, there was nothing wrong with them. There was no reason to decommission them, especially to build another structure that was just exactly like it, or almost exactly like it. And so, from my point of view, it makes a lot more sense to look at these as sort of the final projects of students who were taught stone skills, stoneworking skills. If you imagine that might be possible, that might go a long way to explaining why in various regions of the planet we see such similarity in stonework.
Yeah.
One possible solution is they were all taught by the same people.
Right, right. And that goes back to who were those people who taught that. I mean, the most popular view is that either it's ancient aliens or the Anunnaki, who may or may not have been aliens. But if I remember right, you don't think the Anunnaki were a people.
These questions are difficult ones because of the way this creation system and civilizing plan work. I'll try to explain that a little bit.
Okay.
From the perspective of the Dogon and the Buddhists, when we talk about creation in the ancient mindset, we're talking about three themes of creation, at least three themes of creation simultaneously. We're talking about how the universe formed, how matter forms, and how evolution happens. And in the outlook of the Dogon, those processes are so fundamentally similar to one another that a single set of symbols is used to simultaneously describe all three themes. And so anytime you are talking about the meaning of a symbol, you can only talk about it intelligently if you couch that in relation to one of those themes. What does a hemisphere mean in relation to biological reproduction? It symbolizes a womb, a woman's expanded womb. If we're talking about matter or the formation of matter, a hemisphere represents the concept of expanding mass. In biological reproduction, the process begins with a fertilized egg. If we're talking about the formation of the universe, it begins with a cosmogonic egg. And so each of these symbols carries nuances of symbolism that are different if we're talking about creation of the universe as opposed to creation of matter. And so it gets a little bit complex to distinguish what is symbolic and what is cosmological as opposed to what is factually historic. And in terms of the Anunnaki, there's a level at which everything about the concept of the Anunnaki looks like it's symbolic of biological reproduction to me. And so I don't have firm reasons yet to think that it goes beyond that to a historic level. That doesn't mean that it doesn't. It just means that I don't have that information yet to be able to pin that down. But it's entirely possible that it's completely cosmological and it's about creation.
Okay. Now, just a few minutes ago, you mentioned the Giza Plateau being laid out and coming down. Is that part of your work with Ed Nightingale?
Yes, sort of. The tradition in Egypt is that the plan, quote unquote, fell from the sky. They don't explain what that means, and I'm imagining that it implies something akin to crop circles.
I see.
Because we certainly have seen geometry fall from the sky before. Ed Nightingale is a very good friend of mine. He's a master wood carver from Pennsylvania. He's restored artifacts for the popes in Rome, the Vatican.
Wow.
This is a really talented guy, and he spent the last 20 years sort of reverse engineering what the layout of the structures on the Giza Plateau is about. He's come up with a very compelling rationale, in my opinion, for why things were placed the way they were. He can derive it all from a grid, basically, a grid that makes sense historically and cosmologically in about 14 other ways, and it makes sense mathematically and geometrically, and it ties to the way the concepts of constellations were laid out, in the universe above us. There's all sorts of different things that it ties into, and it seems really sensible to me, and I cooperated with him on trying to get his book written. This
nice.
Last year.
Okay. Is that out?
Yes, it's out. It's called The Giza Template, and that's available, through Amazon and places like that. I'm listed as co-author on the book, but the bulk of the writing and the work is his.
Okay.
Sort of my wife Reese and I acted as his editors and people to bounce, sounding boards to bounce ideas back and forth with. A lot of his work and a lot of the meanings he comes up with overlap with things I've researched, and so we were able to sort of narrow in on some of the perspectives he was gaining through discussion. And I think we generally encouraged him to just find a way to get the book finished.
Nice. Okay. So one of the cosmological themes you keep coming back to in this book for all these different cultures, you see an importance of Sirius, of Orion, and of Barnard's Loop. And why do you think these three points are so important?
That's a hard concept to explain. The Dogons say that the Dogons have a similar practice to the Egyptians. In Egypt, what we see on the Giza Plateau are stones set out that seem to symbolize stars.
Right.
Robert Bovall thinks that the three pyramids at Giza represent the belt stars of Orion. Now, the Dogon have a similar practice where they place large stones on a plateau to represent stars that are important in their cosmology, including the three belt stars of Orion. And with those three, they say that the reason they're placing those stones is to draw our attention to something that they call the Chariot of Orion. The French anthropologists who studied the Dogon imagined that the Chariot of Orion was somehow represented by the entire constellation of Orion. And that's sort of the way he pictures it in his book. But when we get down to it, we realize there's something else going on. It comes down to associations between the concept of a cubit and the concept of a light year. To get to this, in Dogon cosmology, there's a character who represents light who measures out the universe in 8 billion steps. Well, I know the universe doesn't measure 8 billion steps. I also know that the word step is code. It's cosmological code, a symbolic word that means cubit. But the visible universe does measure 8 billion light years, approximately. So it looked to me as if someone were setting up a correlation between cubits and light years. So I asked myself, how did we know how big a cubit was? Well, that takes us back to the dimensions of the Great Pyramid, which measures 440 cubits per side and 280 cubits high. I also knew that Robert Bovall thought that the pyramids pointed to Orion. So I went to a search engine on my computer. I went to Google, and I keyed in 440, 280, and Orion, and pressed Enter. And what turned up were references to an almost invisible spiraling birthplace of stars that encircles around the belt stars of Orion. It centers on the belt stars of Orion. It's called Barnard's Loop. It can only be imaged through time-lapse photography. And when you image it, it looks like the wheel of a chariot that Orion the Hundred is standing in. And to my way of thinking, this is what the Dogon are referring to when they talk about the Chariot of Orion. So, there are symbolic associations between Sirius, the stars of Orion, and Barnard's Loop. They are sort of associated in a triad with one another. One of the chapters in the new book, Point of Origin, talks about concepts of ascension. And this is, again, a difficult one to get at. But the notion is that there's more going on here than just a material universe that we live in. There actually is a second paired universe that behaves a lot like dark matter does in science, but it represents a realm that's associated with our universe, intimately associated with our universe, but that we can't actually see. According to the Buddhists, there is a gate that exists between our material universe and this second universe that they call a non-material universe. And the instructions that they give for how you find this gate involve directional information that connects Orion's belt and Barnard's Loop with the stars of Sirius. So Barnard's Loop ends up becoming important from the concepts of ascension, the concept of ascension meaning finding a way to reach that gateway between the two dimensions. Barnard's Loop is wrapped up in that. There's a lot more to it than that. And anytime we talk about triads or trinities in the archaic tradition, from my perspective, that's what we're implying. We're implying that we're talking about Sirius and Barnard's Loop and Orion's Belt.
All right. And this is where it gets really deep when you get into the whole dual universe thing. And I mean, if you're right, How would these ancient peoples have known about this stuff? I mean, this is beyond what we know technically.
Right. Well, pretty much everything that the Dogon tell us that is scientifically based goes beyond what we know. When they talk about matter, they talk about all of the same structures that Stephen Hawking or Brian Greene talks about, but they also go further down the scale than Brian Greene or Stephen Hawking do. They go so far as to talk about how is it exactly that an act of perception causes matter to change its behavior from being like waves to being like particles. There's a reason that happens, and the Dogon talk about it, but astrophysicists don't.
What do they say about it?
Okay. Again, these are not easy topics. According to Einstein, the reason the speed of light is constant, no matter how fast you travel, is because the faster we go, the more time frame slows down. And so the speed of light looks to us as if it's traveling as fast as it always was because our frame of reference has slowed down. That's what basically E equals MC squared says. It says no matter how fast we go, the speed of light is always going to look like it's going the same speed in front of us.
Right.
You would, okay? So acceleration or speeding up is an equivalent to an increase in mass scientifically, that a body that becomes more massive is effectively the same as if you've accelerated the body. It's just like if you accelerate your car, it's harder to stop it, just as if it were heavier when it's not really heavier. Okay, so as you go down the scale, down to where matter behaves like waves, at the point where it behaves like waves, it virtually has no mass. But if it has no mass, then this whole structure of time frame that slows down as you get more massive must be speeding up as you get less massive. The idea is when you get down to the bottom of the structure, events must be happening at an ultra-fast time frame compared to ours. In other words, effectively, everything happens at once when you get down to the waves.
Okay.
Now, it also means that those waves have no acceleration. So Heisenberg says that if we are dealing with a small enough particle, the simple act of observing it has to disturb it. There's no other choice. That it reaches a point where we can't simultaneously know the location and the momentum of a particle because our act of observing it disturbs it. So when you get down to these massless waves, if you have to disturb them, and they don't have any mass to begin with, the only thing an act of perception can do is impart a little bit of mass to it. And when you do that, you cause the wave, according to the Dogen, you cause the wave to sort of draw up. Like imagine if you had a very thin sheet of plastic and you grabbed it in the middle and pulled it up from the middle. That's conceptually what happens to these waves when they're perceived. And like a car that's traveling very quickly and you slam on the brakes, when you slam on the brakes, you cause the car to start vibrating and shimmying a little bit. Well, that same kind of vibration happens to this wave. When you impart that little bit of mass to it, it's like you're slamming on the brakes in terms of time frame. And so you create vibration and you create a twisting motion, a complicated twisting motion. The best way to describe the motion is it's a pivot. Imagine that you had a bar with two weights and a weight on either end of the bar, and that bar could be balanced on a second bar with a point, like you would have on a scales. The bar with the weights on it could then pivot in any different direction. It could pivot down and around and up and around in circles and so forth. That's what matter is described as being able to do. And at the same time, it also goes through phase transitions, which is the idea of water freezing to become ice or water boiling and becoming vapor. Phase transitions like that happen. And through that process, this wave ends up sort of curling around. It creates bubbles conceptually. And just like when you're blowing bubbles with a bubble wand, the first couple of bubbles you blow don't hold together right. They pop. Until you get enough soap on the soap wand, you can't form a bubble that has enough tensile strength to hold together. And that's what happens with matter too. That as these bubbles start to form, the first six of them pop. And the seventh one finally has enough tensile strength to be able to support its own weight for a period of time. And so that becomes, this cluster of little popped bubbles becomes the fundamental structure of matter. And it can be looked at as a cluster of bubbles, or it can be looked at in another way as a sort of little spiraling vortex, like a water whirlpool that spins around. The dynamics actually of a water whirlpool are scientifically the same as the dynamics of a black hole. And from the perspective of the Dogen, and also the perspective of an astronomic theory called torsion theory, it's the spinning of these tiny vortices at every point in space and time that cause gravity. Essentially, you have teeny tiny black holes at every point in space and time.
Huh. All right. And you find some semblance of this in every culture that you're looking at.
Yes, there are not just semblances of it, but in one of the books I wrote called The Cosmological Origins of Myth and Symbol, that's a mouthful, that I try to lay out what I consider to be signatures of the tradition. For example, any culture that talks about a wheel or a chariot associated with Orion clearly knows about this tradition. Any culture that uses cubits as their first unit of measure clearly was connected with this tradition. And so I lay out a whole series of things that if you find this concept in a culture, that's a signature. It means that they were connected at one point or another to the tradition.
All right. And go on.
No, go ahead. That's right.
When you're talking about this dual reality concept too, this is where some of these teachers are supposed to have come from.
Right. Okay. The Buddhists, when you, in the first couple of pages of the study that I have that describes the Buddhist cosmology that aligns with this Dogen system I'm talking about, the authority on the Buddhist system says the most sacred symbols in Buddhism are deemed to have been given to humanity by a non-human source. He flatly says it. Now, the Dogen say, not only was it a non-human source, but it was also a non-material source, but in a very complicated way. One of the key issues that the teachers of the Dogen had, according to the Dogen priests, was they were concerned about what the long-term effects of our contact with them were going to be on us. It wasn't safe for us to be around them for a long period of time. And so their solution to that problem was to sequester 8 Dogon tribes people at a remote location, and Göbekli Tepe looks like that, one of those remote locations, and then instruct those 8 tribes people in the civilizing skills and the cosmology at that remote site, and then deliver them back to their original homeland and let them teach their tribe mates about the information. And so all around the world, and South America and China and Asia and Africa and every place you look pretty much, you have this tradition of 8 mythical ancestors who brought civilizing skills with them in ancient times. So that's where that comes from. But the idea is that the teachers who imparted this stuff, first of all, they were not providing us with theory. They knew how things work and worked, and they were giving us the straight truth about how things like matter form.
Right.
This is not, I think string theory might be right. It's, listen, guys, this is how it works.
And this, I mean, it sort of connects into the ancient alien thing, but at no point do they necessarily say these are like nuts and bolts aliens. In fact, quite the opposite.
No, and really, the whole question of aliens ends up shrinking to nothing, and I'll try to explain why that is. There's some people who think that this ancient tradition was a remnant of a prior culture that got decimated by the Ice Age.
Right.
The idea is that humanity became civilized a long time ago, and there's signs that might be true. But the nature of the information, the scientific information that's in this tradition, is so advanced. We're talking about what's outside of our universe, and we're talking about what existed before our universe. These are questions that your average academic is not going to be able to figure out without also being space capable. And so even if you were to assign this knowledge to an ancient culture, the implication is that they had the ability to go out in space and research these things. In other words, they were the space aliens.
Right. Okay.
So it's a moot question. It's either we were smart enough to be able to go out and do that, or somebody else was smart enough to come here.
Well, isn't it also possible if they come from a dual universe, like another universe that's connected to ours, that they may have a view of it that is different from ours, that is not as limited?
Yes, and that's one of the things that are going on. The idea with this non-material and the material universe is that the non-material side can see us, but we can't see them. The non-material side has perfect knowledge, but because they live in a massless universe, there is no duration of time. Basically, the dimension of time doesn't exist. All events happen at once. And because there's no duration of time, there's no ability to act compared to us.
Mm.
Now, on our side, on the material side, we have imperfect knowledge, but we have perfect ability to act. And so there's sort of a yin-yang going on between the two universes where the idea in some of the philosophies that underlie this stuff is that there are active attempts being made from the non-material side to induce us to act in certain ways. It's sort of like playing a game of password or a game of charades where you're not allowed to come out and actually directly say the thing that you want or the thing that is the answer. You can only hint at it. And through those hints, try to induce somebody to give you the answer. And that's the sort of thing that these ancient philosophies are describing as going on. You know, vivid dreams that some spiritual person has a vivid dream and claims to receive knowledge from some higher source that turns out to be correct. Or coincidental references turn up in the daily life of a person over and over and over again until they decide to pay attention to them, and that leads them to something. Or even people like Tesla and Einstein claimed that there were some non-traditional things going on with the information that they were presenting.
And I may have mentioned this last time you were on, but it makes me think of John Keel's work when he talks about whatever these UFO things are, whatever these occupants and such are, they seem to know stuff that they shouldn't be able to know unless they were outside of our universe, which
right.
is part of why he leans toward the whole ultra-terrestrial idea that they're coming here from another dimension or someplace above us where they can see the future, past, and it's all one thing to them.
I think there's that aspect to it, but I don't rule out the possibility that there is what I call the traditional sci-fi alien aspect to it also. There are signs that there might have been, if you imagine the Ice Age as having been a great calamity akin to a cyclone coming through New Orleans, I mean, a hurricane coming through New Orleans, or an epidemic hitting Haiti, that sort of thing. Now, a group like the Peace Corps comes in from the outside and makes a sincere effort to try to help that group get back on their feet. Well, it looks to me as if after the Ice Age, somebody came here and did that for us. But it also looks like they might have been delegated by somebody else to do it, and that it might not have been one group, but a consortium of several groups that did it, and some of them may have been non-material and some of them might not have been.
Huh.
And so there may be an intermix of things going on based on some of the ancient images that you see some of these cultures having created that are really, really hard to explain. How did a hunter-gatherer think to imagine somebody that looked like this?
Right, right. Well, I think also you have some evidence that altered states of consciousness might have played into that. And again, I mean, maybe that's also touching on this other universe.
It might be, and some people try to emphasize that, the idea that through the use of particular drugs like ayahuasca or things like that, that a person can improve their ability to connect to this non-material side, and it might be possible that they can. But in the traditions that I study that have done the best job of preserving this stuff, there is no hint... There is no recommendation that is the way that it ought to be done.
Mm.
The perspective is that it's a matter of paying attention to the things that are going on in our real domain, the domain of our real world, that there are clues that this is happening. I'll give you another example. When my wife, Risa, and I had our first baby, our son, Isaac, he was bottle fed, And when you feed a baby a bottle after a period of time, they're getting some air along with the milk. You have to stop and put them on your shoulder for a minute to burp them and let the air come out before you feed them, try to feed them more milk. Well, we noticed by paying attention to him, close attention to him, that after a period of time, he started raising his arms up when he wanted to burp. And when we figured that out and noticed him raising his arms, he communicated to us when he was ready to burp. We put him on our shoulder, he'd burp, and that was it. We didn't have to guess anymore.
Right.
Well, in my experience, and in the experience of some of the other researchers I know who are involved in this field, there may be similar things going on in the real world that we're not used to paying attention to. And that by simply paying attention to them and taking them seriously and considering what would it mean if this coincidence wasn't really a coincidence, what if the fact that the same concept has come up 5 times in the last week in different situations, maybe that means I need to explore that concept. Or if this vivid image has turned up in my dream 3 nights in a row, maybe I need to consider why.
Right. Right. Following synchronicity.
Right. And just being willing to ask the question, what if? Realizing that some of it is wishful and some of it isn't, and that you have to develop skills for distinguishing the wishful from the non-wishful.
All right. Well, we got to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Laird Scranton.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and not necessarily those of WVBR or its management. Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight, we are talking with Laird Scranton. Laird's latest book is Point of Origin, Göbekli Tepe and the Spiritual Matrix for the World's Cosmologies. It's out on Inner Traditions. And all your books have been on Inner Traditions, haven't they?
All but the first one. The very first one I self-published through Ex Libris. It was called Hidden Meanings, and that book eventually found John Anthony West, and he was instrumental in finding Inner Traditions to republish it as The Science of the Dogon, and then since it I published with them. But I would encourage anybody who has an inkling to write a book not to be afraid to self-publish it. It's so inexpensive to do it these days that it's worthwhile doing.
Okay. Now, one of the things you talk about briefly was hints of another group of non-material beings that maybe don't want to help mankind?
The way that the esoteric tradition works in these ancient cultures, again, the best example is the Dogon. In Dogon culture, if you're a priest and I'm an initiate, as long as the question that I ask you is appropriate to my initiated status, you're required to give me a truthful answer. But if I or anybody else comes to you and asks you a question that is inappropriate to our initiated status, you're required either to remain silent or to lie if you have to protect the secrets of the tradition. Now, that structure means that any Dogon tribes person, male or female, can potentially learn the innermost secrets of the tradition if they continue to pursue it and continue to ask the next question that is pertinent, you know, that comes up, that it presents itself. However, an outsider can't learn it. An outsider who comes in and tries to find out about it will be met with either silence or people saying, I never heard of that. I don't know what you're talking about. which actually there was a Belgian anthropologist who went in and tried to restudy the Dogon on a short time frame, didn't have a working relationship with the long-term working relationship with the priests who knew the stuff. And he came away feeling like, I compare it to a parent who goes to freshman weekend at a college and comes away having not seen any evidence of alcohol or drug use.
Fair enough.
Now, that tradition makes it look like someone was trying to hide information from somebody. If you're hiding information from outsiders, you must expect that there are outsiders who are trying to learn about it. And the likeliest motives I can think of for doing that are either you're providing instruction that somebody else doesn't want you to provide. That's the likeliest reason.
Right.
Because surely you're not, the information itself is not top secret, because any tribesperson can learn it if they pursue it. So that makes me think that there's a second group. Okay, now you get down to around 1500 BC to the jealous god. And the very first statement the jealous god makes is, you will have no other gods before me.
Right.
Now the Hebrew scholars looked at that statement and they said, this statement implies that there were other gods.
Right, that makes sense.
Okay, so it looks to me as if there were two groups in competition with one another. And you look at a myth like the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, the transgression that the serpent made, and the serpent is a symbol that's associated with the archaic traditions that I'm pursuing, the transgression the serpent made was providing knowledge. And I think specifically providing scientific knowledge. It looks to me as if the group that came here to help us was delegated with the understanding that they wouldn't give us science. And during the period of time between when they were delegated and when they actually got here to teach us, they realized the same thing that any good parent realizes. If you're going to tell your child a fable about where babies come from, it needs to be based on some facts, so that later on, when they get the hard truth about how children are created, that the myth you told them will have provided a foundation for them to learn that. And so whoever provided us with instruction in ancient times tried to do it in a way that laid a coherent foundation for us scientifically. There's no other way to do it, no other ethical way to do it.
All right.
And so I think the transgression was that the group that was trying to teach us made the mistake of actually giving us the real science. And the second group was trying to circumvent that.
Now, one of the things you mentioned a number of times in these cultures is the idea that our universe has a flaw. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. This flaw is really the characteristic that distinguishes a non-material universe from a material one. And it has to do with the sequence in which these events of creation happen. It's conceptualized as 8 stages of creation. And as the Dogon describe it, when our material universe formed, the 8th stage happened before the 7th one. It wasn't supposed to. Now, if you think of the fundamental unit of matter as forming as a spiral, what this calls to mind is, and given some other descriptions the Dogon give, is sushi. There are 2 different kinds of sushi. There's the kind of sushi where the seaweed wraps around the outside of the rice, and there's the kind of sushi where the seaweed wraps around the inside of the rice. My feeling, based on the cultures I've studied, is that represents the fundamental difference between what creates a non-material universe and a material one. That the idea is, in this spiral, matter or mass wraps around light. And light is the essence of the non-material universe, and mass or matter is the essence of the material one.
Okay. All right. Let people wrap their heads around that one for a moment.
Yes.
Now, one of the things you also mentioned about the two universes is that there's talk of their reversals. Now, what is meant by that?
An idea that's presented in several of these cultures is that the two universes formed, but in a way that is destined ultimately to reverse places with one another. In Buddhism, they say that eventually everything that's material will become non-material, and everything that's non-material will become material. That reversal will happen. That falls in the category of things that somebody I know and trust says it's going to happen, but I don't have actual proof it is.
Right, right. Okay. Now, you've written a book on Velikovsky as well that we've talked to you about. I think the first interview we did was on Velikovsky. Now, in researching all this, have you found anything new about calendar length and or the stuff Velikovsky says?
I haven't found anything that contradicts Velikovsky. As a matter of fact, a lot of the techniques that I use to explore this stuff are very similar to what Velikovsky used in writing his books. And that's part of the reason I feel a kinship with him and felt like I needed to write a book that followed up on some of his work, is because we're approaching things in the same basic way. To characterize that, we're making qualitative arguments, not quantitative ones. Now, that's also how Einstein worked. Einstein didn't sit down with a calculator and a pen and paper and do math. He basically created a bunch of conceptual mind games or mind puzzles for himself. He imagined, for example, what would happen if you were sitting on a train and you threw a ball up in the air and caught it. And by thinking about that and extrapolating what the effects of doing that would be compared to the effects of things that happen out in the universe, he was able to make some qualitative assumptions about what must be true and then find mathematicians who could help improve it mathematically.
Right. Okay. You also mentioned the Egyptian belief that the sun once rose where it formerly set.
Yes, actually, the next book that I'm writing, the one that's at the publisher at the moment that has just been submitted, I'm calling The Overthrown Boat. And what that term implies is the idea of a boat capsizing. Now, during the stages of the formation of matter, there's a point at which gravity has been created and mass has been created, and the spinning of this this little tiny vortex, it seems to indicate that it reverses itself. Now, it looks to me as if, periodically, the effects of this rotating spiral out in space about near Orion's belt, the spiral I call Barnard's Loop, it looks like the effects of that rotation could theoretically cause a couple of different kinds of reversals for us. One is, it might periodically cause a change in the tilt of the axis of our planet. And if that were to happen, if magnetic or electromagnetic effects were to cause our planet to essentially tip over like a capsized boat, the ice cap would melt, there'd be a gigantic flood, terrible things would happen to civilizations that had arisen, and we'd basically be pushing the reset button or the reboot button on the world. It looks to me like that might happen periodically.
Right.
So that's one thing that this idea of a reversal might involve. Or it might actually imply literally that there's going to be a reversal between universes at some point.
Hmm. Okay. What was I just going to ask you? You're the first one to really tackle this and make some sense of it. One of the things we see at Göbekli Tepe is kind of the outstretched arms as if they're embracing. And I've always found that to be such a weird thing. Like, why would that be something that is so common in some of these images?
Right. When I first saw those arms, okay, there's a pillar at Göbekli Tepe, and it's basically a rectangular pillar with a second rectangular piece that sort of sits on top of it and sticks out a little bit. But along the sides of the pillar, down the sides, are these carved shapes that look like arms that come down along the sides of the pillar, and then hands that wrap around the end of the pillar, like the fingers grasping the sides of the ends of the pillars. So When I first saw that, what it made me think of was an Egyptian glyph that has two arms and two hands that I always thought represented the concept of duality. And so my first impression was that was what this represented. But paying attention to those little cues that happen, I kept coming across references that represented concepts of hugs and embraces. And I kept exploring issues for other people that involved Egyptian words that would lead me back to a page in the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary that where the words were talking about hugging and embracing. So then I got the bright idea to look up Egyptian words for pillar and discovered that one of them was pronounced exactly like a word that means to embrace. And from there, I had enough of a clue to realize that what I was looking at with those arms was an attempt to depict an embrace. But this is an attempt made by somebody who was not very good yet. It looks to me as if they were not very good yet at doing it. What they were trying to convey was the image of a hug. What you've got at 10,000 BC is a tradition that is a matriarchal tradition. It's based on mother goddesses, and it rests primarily on feminine sensibilities. And all the indications are that what was trying to be represented there was the concept of an embrace or a hug. It's important because that spiral where light is inside and mass is outside is conceptualized as an embrace between the non-material and the material universe. And Göbekli Tepe is conceptualized symbolically as a place where the non-material world interfaces with the material world, us. You've also got linguistics involved, that the word Göbekli Tepe ties to an ancient Egyptian word that when you net out all of the interpretive elements that have to go into sorting it out, has four pieces to it. The first one is het, which means temple. The second one is pet, which implies the concept of space. The third one is ka, which represents the concept of an embrace or duality. And the last one is ya, which represents the concept of light. So you put those four together, and what it says is temple of space embracing light.
Huh.
So my feeling is that those arms represent the concept of an embrace, and that concept of an embrace passes down as an important symbolic reference throughout history. It's so important and so much at the center, at the core of the secret ideas of this tradition, that reference to it was actually banned in China at 1100 AD by an emperor.
Wow.
And pretty much all traces of it, you can no longer find any trace of it in China. I had to finally go to Japan to track it down. Linguistics is very important to the process of interpreting this stuff. One of the things that linguistics led me to was an archaic cult, a matriarchal cult, that carried the symbolism we see at Göbekli Tepe down historically through India. And they were ancestral to the Vedic tradition and the Buddhist and Hindu traditions. And it looks to me like the same influences came into Egypt around 4000 BC in Ethiopia. It's all mother, goddess, matriarchal cult. It rests on two goddesses who are considered to be the mothers of Ganesha, the elephant god in India. And Ganesha also ends up being central to a lot of the symbolism. Ganesha is sort of a key that ties the African tradition and the Egyptian tradition and the traditions in India and China all together.
And where do we find the name Göbekli Tepe? I mean, how do we know that's what that place was called?
Well, Göbekli Tepe is what it's called in Turkey in modern times. In the ancient Greek name for the region was Cappadocia. The ancient Egyptian name for the region was Getpetkai, which, given a 7,000 year time difference, is a reasonable phonetic equivalent to Göbekli. And so part of what I do in the book is I try to sort out what possible meanings Göbekli Tepe, the words Göbekli Tepe, could have, and tie those to Egyptian words and make a link that way. But ultimately, where the connection comes is through the archaic names for the god, the goddesses of this cult in India, the Shakti cult.
Now, there's also these naval areas, and that seems, and Göbekli Tepe seems to be one, but there are certain areas on the earth that are considered to be like navels. Does this figure into your work at all?
Yes, it does. One of the potential translations of the, okay, the words Göbekli Tepe have multiple meanings in the Turkish language. And so depending on which ones you pick, you can you have different options as to how you might translate this term. One of the possibilities is hill with a navel. And hill with a navel is a symbolic definition of a Buddhist stupa. Okay, with the stupa, if the stupa represents a hemisphere, and if we're talking about biology, biological reproduction, that implies a womb, and what's at the top center of the womb is the navel. And so the navel is important cosmologically that way. It's a correlate to the axis that defines matter, and the center of that axis is the tree of life, which is same concept but different theme.
So if Göbekli Tepe was an area they went to be taught something, could it be that these other naval areas were also teaching spots?
Yes, there could be. I mean, I personally think we're going to find other mountaintop sanctuaries that are buried the way Göbekli Tepe was. And I think one of the motives for burying it was they were trying this message that was being left scientifically in our creation tradition wasn't for the hunter-gatherers at 10,000 BC. It was aimed at, it was targeted at somebody who had a clue about the science, and that means us. So, because you can't understand what the tradition's about if you don't know what an atom is, and you can't understand what the tradition's about if you don't know what an electron orbit looks like. So the idea is the message is being sent to the email address of the person who knows the science, effectively.
Okay.
So knowing that, burying the site, deliberately burying the site, preserves it for posterity for that same audience.
Now, have you seen connections between your work and Native American symbology as well?
Yes, so there are some things you can do to positively tie it. The Hopi in particular, the Hopi Indians, have traditions that are a lot like the Dogon. The stupa, there is a portable form of a stupa called a yurt in Siberia and Mongolia. And there are a number of different forms of yurts. And one of the forms is an architectural and symbolic match for a Navajo roundhouse. And one of the forms of portable yurt is called a teepee, and it's a match for a Native American teepee. So we can tell, because they have these structures that are essentially stupas, that they also had the tradition. The stupa is one of those signatures of the tradition.
Hmm. All right.
So absolutely, yes, there are Native American groups that have the same stuff.
And of course, we were talking earlier, the Native Americans also have the legends of the Sky People who came down and brought them civilization.
Yes, and I imagine that, again, that falls in the category of things that I imagine are probably true, but I can't prove it yet.
Right.
Part of what I do is a lot like a game of Clue, if you remember the board game.
Sure.
Where Colonel Mustard did it in the library with a candlestick. Now, the player's job, you know, if you say that, if you make the proposition that Colonel Mustard did it in the library with a candlestick, I look at my hand to see if I have any of those cards in my hand. And if I do, I can disprove your theory.
Mm.
Well, part of what I do when somebody says, well, the Native American people talk about sky people who are aliens, I look at my hand and say, is there anything in my hand that could disprove that? And if there isn't, then I allow that there's a possibility that it could be true. I can't disprove it. It falls in the category of things that I'll wait to see. You know, someday I may have something that definitively ties to that.
Right. Okay. All right. So we're just about done. There was one thing I was made aware of this week that I found kind of interesting. I'm sure you know who Mother Shipton is, right?
Yes.
And one of her long prophecies where she talks about all the stuff that's, you know, World War I and World War II, that seems pretty accurate. She talks about this current civilization being destroyed by what sound like comets. And afterwards, she says, and before the race is built anew, a silver serpent comes to view to spew out men of like unknown to mingle with the earth now grown, cold from its heat. And these men can enlighten the minds of future man, which makes it almost sound like here are beings from somewhere else coming in to reestablish civilization.
Right. And with the connection to light, which for me says non-material.
Right, exactly. And I just, like I said, I came across that this week, and I just thought, I wonder if there's some connection there between what's happened in the past and what could happen in the future.
Yes. Now, if you imagine that everything that we see in the universe ends up boiling down to circular, to being circular, basically, or being round, you know, round planets, round sun. The idea that the universe itself might be round, that things spin and they rotate, that things form spirals and they rotate. It's all comes down to roundness and repetition. There's reason to think that time might also be circular.
True.
And if that's true, also, when we think about conceptually about this non-material universe where all events happen at once, on the level of that non-material universe, the concept of time doesn't really have any meaning. It'd be like picking up a book and being able to go to whatever page you wanted to.
Right.
So it's quite possible that this is cyclical, like some of the ancient traditions say, and that the same events are going to repeat again and again and again in substantially the same way, maybe not exactly the same way.
Right.
Like every time you play a video game, you're stepping through the same scenarios.
Right, right. But how they play out exactly varies.
Yeah, it varies a little bit each time.
All right. Now, you don't have an official web page.
No, there is a lairdscranton.com that's actually a fan page. The contact tab on that page does reach me. I mean, I get the messages and I answer them. So if somebody wants to use that to contact me, that's fine. My books can be found at all the usual sources. I think Point of Origin is actually in Barnes & Noble right now, which is very good.
Yes.
My publisher is innertraditions.com, and they're associated with simonandschuster.com. I have author pages on both of those websites. I have an author page on Amazon. All my books are there. Mm-hmm. And pretty much you can Google Laird Scranton, and you would come up with references to places where the books could be found.
Okay, all right. And the current one, which is your sixth book, am I right?
Yeah, this is the sixth book. Good. Wow. I have a hard time keeping track.
Points of Origin, Göbekli Tepe, and the Spiritual Matrix for the World's Cosmologies. And we just basically scratched the surface of the information in this book talking tonight. It's so dense with information and connections, and you back up everything you say with evidence behind it. So it's not a book full of speculation. I mean, there's some degree of speculation, but you're backing up what you're speculating.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your looking at it that way. You know, I think this book is significant. I had it was a very interesting process writing it, and the way the material sort of fell out was a very interesting process for me. I learn as much by writing the book as hopefully the reader does when they read it.
All right. And the next one is going to be called what?
The title has not been I'm called Overthrown, and there are symbolic. Just as there are symbolic reasons throughout this book why it should be called Point of Origin, there's symbolic. The next book why it's called The Overthrown Book. Okay. It's about Scotland and about a little Neolithic village in northern Scotland called Scarabray. But that's how it outwardly appears. But at 3200 BC, the significance of that site to me is as important as the significance of Göbekli Tepe at 10,000 BC.
Wow. Okay. Any idea when that might come out?
It should be in the next year. It should be within the next 12 months. I imagine, given the popularity of Point of Origin right now, that the publisher will probably put some priority on it. So I'm hoping maybe fall of next year.
Nice.
Fall of this year.
Cannot wait to read it. All right. Well, thank you so much, Laird. And we're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation. Here's Worrying World.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Cousin Tatriot, chambers number 1597, and counting.